Hi, I'm Joe Heath.
I'm Tony Heath.
And this is the Watchathon of Rassilon.
Yup.
Talking about the seventh serial of the first Doctor, which is The Sensorites. Six episodes, Strangers in Space, The Unwilling Warriors, Hidden Danger, A Race Against Death, Kidnap, and A Desperate Venture, which aired from June 20th, 1964 to August 1st, 1964. That's all the boring information out of the way.
Thanks for always providing the boring stuff right up front every time.
Yeah, that's how you hook them.
Gotta start with some dry, boring facts right at the beginning there.
And people are like, oh yeah, that I'm into. Then you get into, like, you know, the interesting stuff.
Gets people revved up.
Then yeah. You get into the interesting stuff, like who your special guest is.
Yes, today we have a special guest. His name is Ben Patton. He is the first special guest who was not in our wedding party.
Sorry.
But,
hey, woohoo!
I was in a wedding party with him, because he was best man to previous guest, Ray Friesen, and I was sort of last second drafted into being a groomsman for that.
That's a little sad.
The question that we have to ask ourselves then is, are you exclusively inviting people with whom you have a matrimonial connection with? Is that the theme of this podcast? Is just, it's secretly weddings?
It has been so far.
Yeah, and everybody we have planned to come on has at least been
to our wedding
or in it. So yes, that's the theme. I imagine someday we'll get somebody that's not involved in our wedding.
Hmm.
Nah, we'll just go down the list.
I mean, I was invited to your wedding, and then I asked you guys to cover the airfare and to give me a very nice, I wanted like a suite in a hotel, and I needed a PA, and I wanted a per diem, and you guys said, that's ridiculous, we can't do those things. And I said, well, then I'm not going to your wedding, you guys can get married in hell.
It was a lovely venue, hell.
Yeah, and then I was like, alright, fine, are we still doing the podcast? And you were like, yeah. So, you want to talk a little bit about yourself and what you do and where people can find your shit?
Absolutely, yeah, I'm going to be that guy. Well, my name's Ben Patton, and I'm here to say I'm the Britishest guy in the USA. I'm a writer, comedian, YouTubesman, YouTube Smith. I don't like YouTuber. I don't like that word. That word feels kind of almost derogatory, so I like YouTubesman.
Kind of gross.
Yeah, it feels like someone who's groping for a word to describe someone who does YouTube-y things, and it doesn't quite work for me. But I do a web series called Port Center, where I look at interesting and unique ports and conversions and re-releases of video games, and that has been running now for 2.5 years. I'm currently up to my eyes in pre-production on what will become an ongoing science fiction comedy audio play podcast, which will release 2 half-hour episodes every month with a full cast of voice actors, all of whom have been blackmailed into appearing in this particular nonsense. It's based on a webcomic I used to do, which is also called Jump Leads, which is the name of the show, which I didn't mention earlier because I'm really bad at self-promotion. I'm also a lifelong fan of Doctor Who. I've been watching Doctor Who since before I can remember. My earliest memory of Doctor Who is actually the end credits from the Sylvester McCoy era, but my earliest memory of seeing an episode of Doctor Who is a clip from the second Doctor serial, The Mind Robber, which to this day still terrifies me. So when you guys do The Mind Robber, please have me back, because that is one I have to be present for.
Awesome.
Nice, yes.
I like that your first memory is the end credits. Like, you have no memory of what came before then, or...
I honestly don't know, but I just... The sound of the theme, particularly the theme during the Sylvester McCoy era, is very distinct. And also, because the end credits kind of play over a kind of a swirling, kind of purple galaxy / nebula kind of thing, with the occasional asteroid that looks like a crumpled up ball of paper whizzing past the screen with this kind of very 80s synthesized kind of... The sounds and the imagery of that are so clearly defined in my head. That's the earliest memory that I have of the show.
That's awesome. All right, so The Sensorites.
Before we get into that, I want to say Ben Patton also did the weirdest thing for me.
For you.
Which is he narrated this, like, video essay about sexuality and gender in my videos, which my other friend, Chris Cherry, who previously was on the show, wrote for me, and I was like, I want to get somebody famous to narrate it. And Ben Patton was the closest thing.
I'm the closest thing to fame that is adjacent to your, you know, social circle. Kevin Bacon wasn't available, so you got me.
Exactly. I didn't get anyone to talk to you ever.
I was really aiming for Werner Herzog, and I just couldn't get him. Could you imagine?
No. What because that would be like. So dumb, but I literally cannot imagine.
My brain isn't capable of piecing that together. I don't have the equipment.
Come on, he did Parks and Rec. You can do.
You're right on that level.
Yeah, you could have your own NBC sitcom.
All right, let's talk about the Censorites.
Okay.
What happened, Joe?
It's been so long since I watched it.
Joe, with your notes.
Here goes the vague recollection. My first note just says Strangers in Space, which...
Is the title
of the first episode.
Oh, yes, that makes sense. That note makes sense.
The cliffhanger from the last one is they all get back in the TARDIS and they land and it's, we're still moving. And yeah. What could that possibly mean? We landed on something
and Barbara's like, maybe we landed in something.
And it's... unnecessarily dramatic.
But it was slightly less dramatic this go-around than the cliffhanger at the end of the last episode.
And it turns out that they materialized in the belly of a whale. So that's where we are now. Don't correct it. Let's just go with it. Let's improv an entire Doctor Who serial. Let's just do that as if it was the serial. We'll just make it up. And we'll see if people notice.
I mean, there's only like 8 people, so probably not.
My favorite scene was where William Hartnell was the first Doctor, really like visually impressive for the time, where he morphed into Steve Buscemi, which was really impressive because Steve Buscemi, to the best of my knowledge, had not been born yet, or certainly wasn't an age where his TV and film career had begun to blossom.
Well, that's where the time travel comes in, because you can cull from pop culture from all different eras for this one show that they filmed in the 60s.
This is very true.
That's not what happened at all.
No. Let's talk about what actually happened. So they materialized on the back of King Henry VIII as a wart. The TARDIS chameleon circuit kicks in and appears as a wart on his back with hilarious consequences. All right, fine. They're on a drifting spaceship. Fine, whatever. I don't care. Oh, let's do the podcast properly and talk about the show we actually watched. Oh, fine. I don't care. Whatever you want. Whatever you want. It's your podcast.
I think it's all three things, actually. It's a wart on King Henry inside a spaceship that's inside the belly of a whale.
A star whale.
Russian nesting doll of nonsense. I love it.
And it's the same whale that is, you know, a metaphor for the Doctor being old in the 11th, that 11th Doctor.
You really didn't care for that episode.
It was very heavy-handed, yeah.
Well, the ending was heavy-handed. The rest of the episode was pretty awesome.
Yeah, that's true. But then at the end, it's just like, the whale is old and so are you, Doctor. Over and over and over.
Yeah, they spend 27 minutes with just Amy saying like those like very old and very kind like 18 different ways. It's just her. And you see the Doctor, like she's just standing there and he's sitting on a picnic table, like his head's falling asleep in his arm, and Stephen Moffat's kind of standing off in the background, kind of furiously pointing at Amy, like, pay attention to what she's saying. I feel like we should actually talk about the censor.
I don't know. Can I
actually, before we begin, because I actually own the bulk of classic Doctor Who on DVD, and the Censorites was a recent purchase. In fact, I purchased it because you guys said, hey, you want to come on the podcast and talk about the Censorites? And I said, that's a weird voice you're putting on, and that's not what you sound like, but okay, whatever. So I want to point something out. For anyone who owns the Censorites on DVD, on the cover, they're framed in such a way that you can't really see them from the waist down, so their outfit, because it's grey, looks very similar to the Ood outfit, which I think is interesting because A, with those collars, there are some similarities with the Ood, and B, Planet of the Ood in series 4 of the revived Doctor Who, which is Tennant's third series, establishes that the Ood are from a planet called the Ood Sphere, which is in the same solar system as the Sense Sphere, which is where this particular, or near where this particular story takes place. So, not having, this is one of the very few classic Doctor Who serials that I hadn't seen before. I think there's 10 that I haven't seen, and this was one of them. Not including like the missing stuff. I looked at the cover and thought, I guess they're going to be kind of oody, and they weren't oody at all.
Oh, I thought they were kind of oody.
I mean, there's some similarities.
I could see where someone looked at these characters and thought it would be more interesting if they were kind of like this, and like that's kind of where the Ood came from. I could see, like, pieces of the story, like, taken out and reimagined as the Ood, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I get it. But, I mean, they didn't strike me, particularly in their motivations and their actions in the episode. It struck me as less Ood-esque, Ood-like, than I had been previously anticipating. Which was nice. It was interesting. It was nice to be surprised. It's one thing to have a preconception about what a classic Doctor Who serial is about, and another thing entirely to have those preconceptions shat upon by reality.
Okay, so they're on the ship, and there's two people there, right?
They walk out, and Ian thinks everyone's dead, because that's Ian's
Ian
schtick.
Just decides when people are alive and when people are dead, and he's never right.
It's what he wanted for Christmas. He wanted to decide who lives and who dies.
doesn't he, like, check somebody's pulse, and he's like, they're dead.
Yeah.
And then it's like, no, they were just really asleep.
And there's that one scene where he's walking down the corridor, and there's some people are kind of asleep, and other people are checking senses, and he's just pointing at people going, he's dead, she's dead, they're dead, everybody's dead, woo! And then he starts, like, shooting finger guns in the air, going, pow, 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 pow. That scene was my favorite scene.
that was a pretty good scene, yeah. That's so indicative. That's not how you pronounce that word.
Indicative.
Thank you.
The word was fine, you just dropped a syllable. Indicative.
Which is the opposite of what he normally does, which is add all of the syllables.
Right, because I'm Southern. That really boils down to the core of Ian's character.
Ian is.
Yeah, it's just declaring things alive or dead.
And finger guns.
And finger guns, yeah.
I mean, he did take
in
one
the
out
last,
with his thumb.
Yeah, the last serial, he totally took a dude out with his thumb.
Which I'm not over yet. I'm still super impressed by.
The Aztecs is one of my all-time favorites. I love the Aztecs.
Can we just talk about the Aztecs again?
Let's just do that.
Would that be okay?
I would be fine with that. So, okay, let's try to get back on track. I forgot where we are, but basically, they've arrived on this drifting spaceship, and Ian has killed everyone.
There's two people. There's a man and a woman, and they're asleep, I guess. Or they're in, like, a
deep stasis
kind of,
thing.
Yes.
That's explained later what's happened. But I want to say I really like their rocket lapels.
Yes! They have some very spiffy jackets, and I love them.
I would wear the shit out of those.
When I looked at those coats, I kind of thought, if the guy who designed the Star Trek uniform from Wrath of Khan and the person who designed the outfits from Captain Scarlet and the Mysterons worked together to design a uniform, this is probably almost but not quite entirely unlike what it would look like.
That is a lot of references that I didn't get, but
good job.
It not being like it is fine.
Wait, hang on. So there were two references in there, one of which was Wrath of Khan, which is the greatest Star Trek movie ever made, and the other which was Captain Scarlet.
We've actually seen none Star Trek.
You haven't seen Wrath of Khan? Screw Doctor Who, let's talk about this for an hour. Even if you don't like Star Trek, Wrath of Khan is a spectacular science fiction movie. It is phenomenal.
I know, I do want to see it.
I've actually been wanting to do something like this, but with
Star Trek,
all of Star Trek.
I want to do that. I will absolutely do that. You can call it a Star Trek trek.
The watchathon of what is on.
The Star Trek version.
It's dumb.
She was really proud of it. I haven't told him yet. So they're on a ship?
They're on a ship.
This is the first 10 minutes of the first of the first episode.
They think everyone's dead. Turns out they're not dead. They get some smelling salts and wake up. While they're all waking up, some mysterious hand with mysterious music cuts the lock off of the TARDIS.
Like, as slowly as possible, too, in the most ridiculous way. And it kind of just pops off. And it's like, that seems like a faulty design with your special magic box.
I really liked that, because it's not something that you see a lot of in Doctor Who. You almost never see the physical dimensions of the TARDIS change in any way. And to have what are ostensibly the villains of the piece steal a core element of the exterior of the TARDIS, I actually thought was really cool. It reminded me of Father's Day, when Eccleston goes into the TARDIS and the interior is just not there. I thought it was really cool.
It is definitely an interesting concept. Although
they've played with it once or twice.
The lock in particular.
Yeah.
It can just melt apparently and be locked forever.
Yeah, if you unlock it the wrong way. Like if you put the key in upside down accidentally or something.
Then you're screwed.
They've also played with like stuff affecting the outside, affecting the inside, because they had that whole condensation thing.
No,
in Marco
that upsets
Polo.
Me.
Yeah, that doesn't really make sense. That was just to force a science lesson in.
Oh yeah, a lot of this stuff gets ignored later. Such as, I don't know, all of it.
It's weird how there is no canon at all. There is no continuity, and yet sometimes it can be very continuity heavy, and it's nice.
It's like The Simpsons in that regard. You kind of have to accept that a lot of this stuff is kind of connected, but really it isn't.
So they're trying to decide, I guess, before they realize that the lock's been stolen, they're trying to decide if they should help these people or if they should just go. Because the people on the ship, they've been put asleep, and they know that someone is doing stuff to them, but they're not harming them in any way.
Just keeping them asleep.
And so, I guess Ian and Barbara, or Barbara really, I think, wants to stay. The doctor says, I learned long ago not to meddle in the affairs of other people.
Yeah. He lied.
Ian laughs for days.
I think he literally goes, hoo-hoo!
He does his best Will Smith at the beginning of any of his songs impression. Like, woo! Ha-ha! Ha-ha! It's brilliant.
That's exactly it.
Then this is my favorite thing because this is the last story of season one, I believe.
Oh, there's one more. There's the Reign of Terror.
There's one more? Oh yes, the Reign of Terror. For some reason, my brain always puts the Reign of Terror at the start of season two, like a moron. But yeah, it's like we're near the end of the first season now. I like that the show is already making fun of its own format. I like that.
So they basically find out that the lock's been stolen and they're like, well, I guess we'll stay and help, which is pretty much how every story's gone so far. It's like, well, we can't get back into the TARDIS and just leave, so I guess we'll go on an adventure.
Fine, I guess.
If we have to.
Yeah, and they're going to go try to find this other guy that's on the ship.
There's this one guy on the... There's another trap door, first of all. It's just a normal door. We had a series of trap doors and now they're on my mind. But I guess it's just a normal door. And they go to, like, get water. And Susan and Barbara?
Yeah, and they've, like, very, like, this is how this door works. It takes them, like, 20 minutes to get through the door.
It's like a motion sensor. But I guess that's sci-fi for when it was. But yeah, they go to get water. And, like, the people on the ship send them to get water. And then they're like, oh, wait, did they go down that hallway? The crazy secret person in this episode lives in that hallway.
Don't go down that road. Plenty of history down that road.
That's bad.
I've seen this before, but it's been so long I forgot what happened. And I was like, was there a zombie episode? Is this a zombie episode? Because the guy is stumbling around moaning and looks like he's probably going to eat their brains.
But he's just kind of messed up in the head because the sensorites, we haven't actually named yet, but the sensorites of this episode have messed with his head so much that he can't really think straight.
Oh, and I have a note here that says, Barbara has the ability to hide in plain sight, which she did in The Keys of Marinus when she hid around that slight corner. Actually, this happens a lot. It happened in the Aztecs. Ian hides just by stepping back a little bit.
Slightly and nobody sees him. To the back of the frame.
And like Barbara does it again. I guess that's just low budget. We just have small sets. So just pretend to hide.
Okay, so here's my theory about that. And it's entirely based on no fact whatsoever.
Oh, good. I'm glad. I'm already excited.
My theory about that is they've spent so much time on the TARDIS, and this is early days for this TARDIS, that they have absorbed the perception filter that is established as being part of the TARDIS's wasnamery in Series 3 of the Revived show. So that's why the chameleon circuit doesn't work, is they walked into the ship and absorbed all of the perception filter. The end. Done. Canon. I have decreed it so.
I accept that as canon. It makes sense.
I will say this. I am fiercely against the notion of headcanon because people take their headcanons and fanon, as it used to be called back in the day, far, far too seriously. Which is pretty golly gosh darn ironic considering Doctor Who is a show that is entirely headcanon because there is no established canon for the show. You get to pick and choose. If I decide that I don't want the sensorites to be canon, it's not canon anymore for me. It's like how most people have decided that the Eighth Doctor saying he's half human, spoilers by the way, they've decided it isn't canon, despite the fact it's a key plot point of that story. Everyone else kind of accepts the whole of that movie except for that one plot point, despite the fact that the plot of that movie hinges entirely upon the Eighth Doctor being 50% Earthling.
To be fair, I think he refers to himself as human in this very serial. I think he's actually done it a couple of times, but I think that's just
I think it's
less...
all in, like, phrases.
Yeah, it's sort of like sloppy writing more so than...
At this point, they hadn't firmly established that the Doctor wasn't human. It doesn't really come up in the show's history until really the second Doctor.
Their planet, and they talk... I mean, that description of like silver trees...
Yeah, that's in the serial.
And burnt orange skies, that's from this serial. And I guess it could be, there's some speculation that you were saying that you thought maybe that they were playing with them being just from the future.
That was Vince. Vince said that.
Vince was saying, okay.
Yeah, that they're...
But I feel like it's always kind of been at least an idea that they're not from this planet.
But yeah, there's that, and there's also a bit later on where he mentions his heart and not...
Just the one.
Just the one, not plural.
I don't know when that becomes established as a thing.
I think it's way later.
We see the first Sensorite. Is that in this serial or is that in the one
That's at the very end of this.
Yeah, so the cliffhanger is when Ian's looking out the window and that Sensorite's like, "Hey guys, can I come in? You guys busy? What are you guys doing in there?" He just kind of slowly slides into frame. He's like, "Can I come? Can I play?"
It looks like any of those YouTube videos you see where people are trying to be like, "Oh, I filmed an alien outside my window and it was like six stories up."
It's a guy in a costume. And by the way, can we just say that the makeup, the prosthetic that they made for the Sensorite's head, I think looks phenomenal.
I was really impressed by it. I was like, and I think this is their first real attempt at it. It's like before you've had the Vord, but they were just kind of a weird
Power Ranger
wetsuit fetish thing. And I think this is their first real attempt at alien makeup, and I was really impressed. I liked it.
Yeah, oh yeah, they look absolutely phenomenal.
They look slightly puppety.
Yeah, a little bit. There's something kind of... I could totally see these aliens appearing in, like, original Star Trek, for example. Like, and I'm sure that if you were to look at, like, high-def photography of these things, they probably don't look great, but for the kind of grainy 60s, lower-than-standard-definition film quality that we're looking at for these DVDs, they look absolutely phenomenal. I'm in love with the way the Sensorites look.
Their mouths kind of freak me out. I spent a lot of time watching their mouths when they talk.
They've got that kind of Planet of the Apes kind of mouth where the lips don't move with the person talking.
The reason I say puppet is that I have like this old guy puppet, and they kind of look like if you just stuck the upper lip way down and just lifted the bottom lip way up. But it's got, like, this, like, very fuzzy beard. That's what they kind of look like to me.
They kind of have long mustaches, I guess, that, like, cover the mouths to make it, you know, less obvious that the lips aren't moving, I guess. But, like I said, I just spent a lot of time staring at it.
They look really cool.
Oh yeah, they look fantastic. But I'm with Tony on this one. I spent a not inconsiderable amount of time looking at where their mouths were supposed to be while they talked.
And it just sort of flaps in and out.
Yeah, it's like a crude knife slip.
So that's the cliffhanger. You get to see the Sensorite for the first time, and then we move on to
the Unwilling Warriors.
Dun, dun, dun. We get our recap.
Of him bouncing outside the window.
The thing I love about the recaps for almost the entirety of the first and second Doctor's tenure is the recaps weren't reused footage. It was literally a reshoot because they couldn't just drop the footage back in. So you get like slight differences in the performances. Actually, on this instance, the Sensorite is played by a different actor. Maybe that's not true and I'm making it up, but the body proportions look different the second time around. Maybe I'm lying. I'm probably lying. Am I lying? Yeah, I'm lying.
Yeah, but it's Doctor Who, so it's canon now.
It always seems to me that the cliffhanger is very dramatic, and then the recap is more like just
it's like, oh, there's a guy outside the window. Before it was kind of scary, now there's just an alien head, and do you think he wants to come in?
I will say this, because I have also, while I have been driving to and from work, I've been listening to the Big Finish audios, and I've gone right back to the beginning. I just literally, on the way home from work today, finished listening to Whispers of Terror, which is the third Big Finish audio, and the first one that's a standalone featuring the sixth Doctor, because the first Big Finish audio, The Sirens of Time, had the fifth, sixth, and seventh Doctors working together. And one of the cliffhangers is literally just the sixth Doctor going, "No!"
Yes!
And then they do the recap at the start of the next episode, and it's, "No!" And then there's like a couple of seconds of silence, and he's like, "All right then." And then it just, the story just continues. It's the most... It's the silliest thing.
I love that. I love that so much. Well, there's the one cliffhanger that's one of my favorites is, "Look at this footprint! It's giant!" And then the next episode, Ian's like, "Oh, it's probably just a regular footprint that melted, so now it's bigger." And then the story is completely unrelated to that. moving on.
One of my favorite cliffhangers is from, oh god, I can't remember which series. It's a third Doctor serial. It was originally, I think it was going to be like a 6-part story. They ended up editing it down to 5 parts. And so the cliffhangers kind of all shifted. And most of the cliffhangers are fine, except for this one where it's like, we need to stop walking. There's something on the floor. And then the camera quickly zooms in on the floor. And it's just like checkered tile. And then it's, then the credits kick in. Like, that's the cliffhanger. It's, oh no, the floor.
There's one that I've seen that we haven't gotten to, and we won't for ages because it's the Seventh Doctor, where he's in this, like, ice cave, I guess, and he's walking along, and he just decides that he's going to try and climb down it, and so he hooks his umbrella on the edge of the thing, and just hangs there.
Dragonfire. That cliffhanger appears in The Name of the Doctor, the season 7 finale, where you've got one of the echoes of Clara kind of looking at him, kind of like, what the hell are you doing? Why are you doing this? What's wrong with you? It's delightfully stupid.
Can't wait. That's something to look forward to.
So the sensor right at the window appears, and Carol and Maitland kind of all freeze up, right?
Oh yeah, they go back into their kind of stasis.
And then we see their pancake feet.
The sensorites?
The sensorites
have pancake feet. That's right, I forgot.
More clever monster design.
And then you've got that one guy whose name is John, who we haven't named yet, but that's his name. His name's John, and he's kind of
just freaking out.
Oh yeah, he's not in good spirits. But then it turns out that he's in touch with the sensorites, basically, and they're trying to convince him to. Is it in this episode where he has that moment where he's like, they want me to scare you away, and he's holding Barbara's hand, and he's like, I won't do it, I can't, like, just, and like, you're freaking out, mate. Like, that's gonna scare me away on its own. Plus, also, slight flaw in the sensorites' plan. They're trying to scare Team TARDIS away when they've also taken away the lock from the TARDIS. Like, doesn't that seem, you know, that doesn't work.
What do they want?
Sending mixed messages there.
I think that's been a problem throughout this entire season, is the villains' plans are never very well thought through.
They're not sure if they want Team TARDIS to leave, or if they want them to stay so that they can steal things from them.
Like, you have that, you have T'Gana almost leaves himself stranded in the desert with no water in Marco Polo.
Yes.
You have in the Aztecs, is she supposed to be a god or a priestess? And if she's a reincarnated thing of a priestess, and you're going to try to kill her to prove that she's not a priestess, but she's already previously died, it's this whole, like, things were clearly not thought through.
It's not smart.
I don't know if I'm jumping ahead, but we all only vaguely remember this, so I'm just going to go ahead and go with it. It turns out that Susan's really good at telepathy, which is actually, I thought was kind of interesting, because the Doctor is not very good at it. In fact, I don't think he cares for it. I think it kind of freaks him out a little bit.
Yeah, I kind of like that. Yeah, Susan does this thing. She talks about these plants. The Doctor was like, oh, they communicate by telepathy, probably. And Susan's like, oh, neat, and walks in front of the plants, and the plants, like, screech at her and yell at her because they're interrupting her. She's interrupting their thought patterns. So she's like, okay, so I guess I'm psychic now.
That didn't make any sense to me, so I liked it a lot.
So far, Tony's favorite episode has been The Edge of Destruction, so she likes the ones that don't entirely make sense.
Something about them delights me, where I'm just like, yeah, okay, I'll go with that concept.
The Edge of Destruction is like an avant-garde French art house movie. I love it. It's ridiculous.
It was everything I've always wanted from Classic Who.
Barbara and Susan managed to make the sensorites fall over by just thinking the words, we defy you, over and over. It kind of feels like, don't think about elephants, and the sensorites are like, oh, now we're going to be thinking about elephants all day.
They're very sensitive, the sensorites, to, I guess,
everything.
Everything.
To defiance, apparently.
Light, loud noises, harsh thoughts.
Yeah, you're harsh and mellow, man.
That's literally all you have to do to defeat them, and we spend 6 episodes fighting with them.
That's it. Just think, now you're dumb, we're going to win. And then they're like, oh, okay. And then that's it. Less than 15 minutes into episode 2, they should have just grabbed the lock off of the sensorites and been like, peace out, y'all, we out. And just left.
Well, that is a thing that Ian, like, says in episode 1 that's basically like, why not violence? And like,
that's every line he has, though.
It kind of is, and there's this fantastic scene where the sensorites, they're very peaceful, I guess. They don't want to use violence at all, but they're very wary of people.
Yeah, because of their molybdenum mine. They're molybdenum.
Good job. Nailed it.
They have a mine in their planet of a very precious, hard to pronounce
resource.
Yeah,
I said it.
Yes. That Joe totally nailed when he said it.
It's melatonin.
People have been coming to the planet and trying to take it, and that freaks them out. But like I said, they're very peaceful, and they don't want... That's why they've been kind of just putting these people to sleep. Because they don't want them to come to their planet, but they don't want to hurt them. So they're like, we'll just keep messing with their heads and...
Molybdenum. That's... There we are. I was trying to think of how to pronounce it. Molybdenum. Named after British video game developer Peter Molyneux.
Really?
Not true. Made that up. No, I'm a liar.
You're very convincing.
It's the accent. The accent lends everything I say with a degree of authenticity that is neither earned or deserved.
That's why I got you to do that video essay.
It did sound very official, or officious, one of the two.
But there's this scene where literally all the Sensorites are doing are slowly walking towards Ian around the entire ship. I mean, the scene goes on for minutes,
right.
For entirely too long. They're just very slowly walking towards Ian, and Ian is slowly backing up away from him like, I will hit you. Quit. Come on, guys, stop.
Is it funny anymore?
Guys, stop. I am going to hit you.
I'm going to tell Mom.
Ian's like, I don't understand why I can't just hit them. And Barbara's like, Barbara and Susan are both like, they haven't done anything to you. And Ian's like, but it's annoying.
And then we have the scene, they figure out that they're scared of the dark because of their eyes.
It doesn't make any sense, but yes.
If we give the ship a cold, that's the equivalent of it.
It's delightful nonsense.
But it turns out to be true.
So yes, they turn out the lights and escape from being slowly walked at.
I think we're already in episode 3, by the way. Hidden danger!
Hidden danger. The danger is that we hit the cliffhanger.
Well, it was Susan left with the...
We totally missed the part where Susan's all, hey, so I'm going to go live on the Sensphere now so that you guys don't get killed. Okay, cool, love you, bye. And then that's the cliffhanger.
They just watch her go, too.
There's no fight there.
And I love that they're on a spaceship and the two Sensorites have to, like, close the door like it's a gazebo or something. They just pull it down.
And then the next episode starts, and then they're like, oh, wait, we better stop her. And then, like, immediately open the door. And the sensor lights are like, whoa, wait, you can do that?
Wait, guys, we said no take-backsies.
Can I just point out just the absurdity of some of the cliffhanger resolutions? Imagine having to wait a week to find out that that's how the cliffhanger... A week of, oh, no, the Sensorites have Susan, what are we... Oh, how are they going to get out of this one? And it turns out just the answer is them going, no thanks. Like, that's the whole thing.
On second thought, maybe we don't want that to happen.
It's like the closest I can think to for modern Doctor Who that has had that level of nonsense is actually the cliffhanger from The Empty Child, where all of the empty children, the gas mask people are closing in on the Doctor, Rose, and Captain Jack. Harkness, not Sparrow, that would be weird. The way that cliffhanger is resolved is the Doctor saying, go to your room, and it's like, that's nonsense, I love it!
I got so excited when you started talking about it, because I was like, yes! That is one of the best cliffhangers. Because then immediately afterwards, he's like, I'm sure glad that worked. Otherwise, it would have been dumb.
Those would have been terrible last words. That's what he said. And he's right. Go to your room. Stupid.
But so great.
And then we have this whole, like, weird metaphor about, like, Susan dating the Sensorites.
What?
And the Doctor not being cool with that. And then she's like, I gotta live my own life.
It's a little guess who's coming to dinner.
I enjoy Susan being like, you have to let me do things because I never do anything and it's starting to get really boring for everyone.
And the Doctor's like, we never had an argument until I accidentally kidnapped these guys.
Yeah.
You know what I want? I want a parody of Meet the Parents where the father person is, the Robert De Niro character is the first Doctor. And the daughter is Susan, and the date is a Sensorite. Like, is it Ben Stiller? Yeah, he's a Sensorite. And that's... You just do that, you do it straight.
I just got really freaked out by a psychic Ben Stiller. Something about that is off-putting.
That should be his next movie.
I might make that.
Put Jump Leads on hold, this is your next project.
This is my baby.
It could be a Dalek Gary spinoff.
It could be a Dalek Gary. Oh, this is too good. I'm making a note of this. I might legitimately do it.
Yes!
It means I will have to watch Meet the Parents again, but that's a sacrifice I'm willing to make.
They end up going on to the Sensorite.
Well, they split up, which Ian doesn't like, despite having suggested it every serial before.
Can I just point out, by the way, I'm right now, I have the TARDIS data bank entry for the Sensorites right now, and it says, when the Doctor tries to grab Susan, the Sensorites draw a weapon. I don't actually remember that happening.
I remember the weapon.
I don't remember the Sensorites being like, boom, here's a gun or something.
It's like a radio antenna or something.
Oh no, I do remember that. Okay, I'm with you. I'm on the
but
same
what does it do? Does it just, it, like, immobilizes a person?
It only picks up Jazz FM, annoying everyone.
Because, like, I remember way later, they get a one that doesn't work.
Yeah, that one picks up, like, contemporary jazz. I just used jazz again. That joke doesn't work. I ruined it. Contemporary pop music would have been better.
God damn it.
Like, when it doesn't work, it's Jazz FM. When it does work, it's, like, NSYNC.
There you go. You got there.
I'll edit this around somehow so that you're funnier.
So that you made it first try.
Here's what I'm just going to say the words, contemporary pop music, and then you drop that over contemporary jazz, and then edit yourselves laughing, and then continue. It's fine. You can make this work. You can make it work in post. We have the power. We can succeed where classic Doctor Who producers fail. We can edit around the mistakes.
So how do they end up going on the planet again and splitting up? Before we get there, I do want to go back to Ian has, in fact, like every time before, been the one to suggest that they split up. And it's not just that he's like, I don't like splitting up. It's he's like, I have never liked the idea of splitting up. Every single time I've been against it. And it's like, Ian, that is not true.
He's like an abusive husband. He's like, what's the expression? Gaslighting? He's gaslighting the other team. It's like, I've always hated pistachios. You were eating pistachios this morning. No, I've always hated pistachios. How dare you? I told you I was going out for drinks with the guys tonight. You never brought it up. I've told you the 2 times this morning, once last week. We've been planning this for months. What's wrong with you?
That's the thing about Ian is he's very inconsistent, but whatever he believes in that moment, he has always believed forever.
In many ways, he's like Fox News. I have never described people on welfare as lazy. When have I ever said that? Well, here's Jon Stewart with 1,000 clips of you doing that.
I can't read my notes.
Somehow they split up and they all go back to the planet?
It's the Doc, Susan, and Ian. Barbara stays on board because she probably needs to take a holiday or something.
She's not really going to be in the next couple episodes.
I had a trip to Cornwall booked with my family, so I'm going to stay here. See, I'm going to look down. Let me go down let me find out if there's a... Jacqueline Hill does not appear in A Race Against Death and Kidnap as she was on holiday while they were filmed.
Booyah. That's generally what it is. The Doctor does that too. Like, oh, I've hit my head.
I like it when it's just see like, ya. I'm going to take a nap. I'm just going to take a nap for 3 of these 6 episodes. You guys carry on with the plot. So they're on the planet, and on the planet, this is either this episode or the next episode. I don't remember.
No, it's this. They land on the, they go to the planet. They're worried about bringing them because they think humans have brought disease.
Which, fair enough.
It is kind of our thing.
Right? That's like kind of what we do is we go places and like, we'll have some of that and we'll leave you with some of these awful things like diseases and stuff. And all right, see you later.
It's kind of what happened was, and this I'm going to read this word for word for the TARDIS databank. They recount a story of humans visiting the Sensphere. In their eagerness to leave and inform the rest of their people about the riches of the Sensphere, they crashed. That's like a 2,000% success rate. It's like, that is a greater rate of failure than the couple from the Pina Colada song. That is a song about two people trying to commit adultery and failing so phenomenally, and instead of going, wow, we can't even cheat on each other properly, maybe we should just jump into the giant whirring blades of a comically oversized blender, they laugh it off and have some sex on the beach. Like, that's ridiculous. But this is worse, because it's like, hey, we're going to tell everyone. Oh, wait, no, now we're dead. And then that crash releases a bunch of pollution, which poisons the Sensorites. The end. Is this the conversation with the BDSM Sensorite, by the way, who's just wearing that black, like, crisscross outfit?
Yes. Oh, that's my favorite concept in these next couple of episodes. Susan, I think, says something like, I probably couldn't even tell the difference between you if I didn't see your fancy suspenders. And this one Sensorite who has a fancy collar is like, that's the best thing I've ever heard. I'm gonna steal his fancy suspenders.
I think he would have been like, oh, I'm wearing this collar, but whatever, it's cool. It's fine.
Susan, what a racist.
You all look the same to me.
Sensorites, am I right? You ever notice that sensorites drive like this? Brrr, but oods drive like this? Meh.
I'm gonna get us back on track here. We can do it.
Good luck. You're doing God's work, Tony.
You're jumping way ahead, though.
Then you get us back on track.
Oh, I don't know.
No one knows.
Okay, I want to say
someone's gotta land this plane.
Pointed out this story.
No, because we got the illness and the sensorites are like, well, the humans left and then they didn't leave because they crashed and died and now we're all diseased. And the doctors all, oh, that's cool. I'll figure it out. I'll have you cured in sometime between the next 4 to 6 weeks. No problem.
Yeah, but you said that story, which I completely forgotten. And then when it's eventually brought back, like, 3 episodes later, I was like, this came out of the blue, because I completely forgotten that it happened.
And that's fair, because it's kind of glossed over fairly quickly.
I think about this all the time when we watch them, we sit down and we watch them all in a row, and really long ones will maybe take 2 days, because I can't watch people wander in the desert.
For 8 hours.
But I always think about, I get to like the last episode and I'm like, oh yeah, this plot is happening. I can't imagine doing that over a course of several weeks. Of just being like, oh yeah, that was the plot that was happening 3-4 weeks ago.
Oh, was I supposed to remember that key plot point?
Because the reason I sort of like immediately dropped that thought from my head is like, this is clearly the thing to throw you off, because that's not what's really causing the disease. It's the water.
I'm remembering
which it's
things.
Very obvious that it's the water, because, like, Ian drinks it and falls hilariously.
I love every time Ian falls, because he's so gentle, because he doesn't want to hurt himself, and it's precious every time.
It's so funny because he's, as a character, he was designed to be the tough one of the group, which is why he's always like, let's punch our way out of problems! And then he falls and he's like a delicate porcelain doll.
I think Ian is such a delightful mix of like stereotypical like tough man stuff, but the way he plays it, he's like so against that.
He's such a giant goofball. Like, yeah. I'm the action hero figure of this thing, totally. I've just tripped and fallen over nothing, as delicately as possible.
It's like the opposite of seeing like Hulk Hogan or Vin Diesel in a Disney family movie.
Yes.
It's like casting Pee Wee Herman as the Terminator. It's like this. It's just, it's so against type, but it's kind of beautiful in its way.
So Ian...
That was the end of...
They bring the water, and the guy's like, don't bring them this water, bring them the same water as me, the head fancy suspender sensorite.
Are we calling him fancy suspender sensorite or BDSM sensorite?
BDSM.
Okay.
Well, because you got one wearing the exposed nipple leather straps, and then you've got the one who's literally collared, like... Who is clearly a submissive sensorite, sexually. I don't want to take this podcast down a dark avenue, but we're looking at... This is clearly, like, a sex thing for them.
Okay, so let's say the leader is Dom, and the collar is Sub.
Dom and Sub, that's it. That's their names now.
And I think that is, like, the Dom is the main Dom leader, and the Sub is, like, the second
but
leader.
But he doesn't... He's tired of playing bottom. He wants to be tops.
Well, no, there's one guy under that. I don't think he has anything. That's the guy that's all like...
He just likes to watch. He's just present for the whole thing.
He's like, he's the one that's like, let's kill everybody.
I don't know, because all the sensorites look the same.
There's like a quiet, unguarded moment where he leans into Susan and says, you know what, if it weren't for the collar and the nipple suspenders, I would have no idea who's doing what to who. The fronds on these guys, I mean, these are some impressive, they're very well endowed, but I'll be honest, I have no clue. I have no clue.
Me either.
So Ian collapses from his drink.
And he's sick. He spends an entire episode being
sick.
And
that is the end of Hidden Danger, and we are now in a race against death.
I want to talk about Ian being sick and how much I love it. I love Ian being sick. It's something I find delightful.
Ian's sick acting was brilliant because it's just him talking and then occasionally interrupting himself to go, I'm sorry, and then continuing the line.
I love any time a character I really like is injured in any way. I apologize for that, but that's just how I am.
So you would fit in with the sensorites. The kinky sensorites.
Yeah, probably.
We have a note here that says the doctor licked something. I remember that made you very happy.
Because I've talked frequently in the podcast about how they're very careful in Classic Who where it's like, we don't know what that is. Maybe poked it with a stick a couple of times, and I've said that, and knew who, the doctor would be, like, licking it already. Like, he'd already have it halfway in his mouth and be like, oh, no, it might explode. Here, let me eat it. And so when he's testing the water, I think he's doing tests on the water to figure out, they know the water is poisonous. He's just trying to figure, to like localize it, to figure out which water source has the poison in it. And he licked something and I did get very excited. Well, you got it. You got excited. You're like, he licked something and now you can stop talking about it.
The role of the companion in modern Doctor Who is to basically say, get that out of your mouth. Okay, spit it out. Spit it out. Spit it, good boy. And in classic Doctor Who, the Doctor's role is to basically be, oh, for fuck's sake.
Why did I kidnap these people?
It's like, there are several points where he's like, oh, I kidnapped some people. Oh my god, I can't believe. Why did I, oh my god, and they have families. These people have families. Oh my god, I'm a criminal. I'm going to jail. I'm going to so many jails. I'm going to every jail.
I just realized we completely forgot to say in the last episode there was a ridiculously complicated gun that like shoots people in different rooms and they have to like calibrate it.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so there's the sub.
Well, sub. He doesn't have
anything. He's the real evil one?
The real evil one. He's the Tagana of this
episode. He's the Tagana of this episode. He wants to kill, you know, Team TARDIS because
they're humans and he's racist.
And also, I think he wants to take over and he wants to be head censorite.
He wants to be the top and the dumb.
And he wants to use violence. He's like, I don't understand why we're being so peaceful all the time. People are going to come here and take our stuff if we're not going to do anything about it. So we should just start killing people. And the other censorite's like, yeah, that sounds cool. I'm on board with that.
And then he gets stopped, but then Ian gets sick anyway.
So, oh, cool, we don't have to do anything. Awesome. They've just killed themselves. It's great.
Perfect.
And then they're going to cure John on this planet by putting him in Cerebro.
Cerebro.
Magneto.
Beautiful. What's a Magneto?
That was genuinely impressive. And then?
I'm out of X-Men jokes. I got batch swapping, the doctors. I don't know what any of this means. Censorite handwriting? What the hell am I talking about?
Your notes are awful.
I think you're writing notes for a Censorite sitcom spinoff. I think that's what that is.
Oh, wait. Yeah, the doctor's like, let's test this water out. And they're like marking the samples and stuff. And like the Censorite has like the best handwriting I've ever seen. I was super impressed.
Well, hey, that Censorite didn't pay for 8 weeks of calligraphy school for nothing, okay?
The doctor creates an antidote. He gives it to which Censorite? One of the bad ones.
Well, I think he gives it to an alright one.
Oh yeah, he gives it to an alright one and is like, here, go bring this to Ian so he doesn't die. Literally, Ian is told that he has like 3 days to live, by the way. It's not just that he's like sick.
Oh, it's brilliant. That moment is fantastic. It's like, oh, no one lived any longer than 3 days. And the doctor's like, oh, cool, we can chill out. It's going to take 3 days. We got plenty of time. It's fine. He'll just die slowly and we'll work on a cure. Probably, I don't know, unless, is there anything good on TV, you know, okay, then let's make a cure, whatever. The doctor's like, okay, well, that's plenty of time, we're good, we're copacetic. There's such a casual delivery of that, it's fun, it made me happy. 3 days? We don't even need to start now, let's go bowling, come on, guys.
So he passes off the antidote and's like, go give this to Ian so he doesn't die, we have like a day left. we have maybe half an hour. Just stroll it down to him.
The grumpy villain Censorite's like, this is probably a trick. Let's not save our people. And destroys the antidote.
For some reason, the doctor goes down to like the water.
Oh, the aqueduct.
The aqueducts.
The aqueduct.
Why does he do that?
Because he wants to, like, see if there's anything causing the poison in the water.
Is this before or after he's like, hey, I should go to my TARDIS? And they're all like, nah, son, just use our lab. Whatever, bruh.
I think this is after.
Yeah, okay. they've already discovered that it's that specific water.
The TARDIS databank entry for the Censorites at this point describes the Censorites not allowing him to use his TARDIS as, this upsets the Doctor, who shouts at them.
Oh, no, but he does. He shouts at them because loud noises hurt their ears, and Susan gets really mad. It's like, you can't shout at them, it upsets them. And the doctor's like, they're keeping me from getting into my TARDIS.
And this is the thing, because you actually see that in episode, I think it's episode 2 or 3, someone's yelling, and it's not this scene, but someone else is yelling, and you can see the sensorites like covering their ears, but trying not to make a big deal about it. Because it's like, well, we're being yelled at, and it's supposed to hurt, so we'll put our hands up, because people think, oh, they're putting their hands up. But they won't think, oh, well, this is clearly, it's a callback where they were like, well, we shouldn't do this, but whatever. It just felt like a lazy way of going, yeah, but they were pretty pissed off about it before, so whatever.
They were trying to be cool before, but... So the doctor goes to the aqueduct, and there's bad news there. And...
Yeah, they're like, nobody's ever went in there and came out alive!
And someone tells this to Ian, who has a day to live, who is dying, and he's like... I'm gonna go after him. And everyone's like, Ian, no. Ian, lay down. He's like
shit, I got this.
I gotta go after him. I gotta go be an action movie. And he does, and it's precious, and I love it.
And then, like, we hear the sound of a monster attacking the doctor or something, and that's the end, that's the cliffhanger. And then we get the most interesting title for an episode, which is just Kidnap.
Yeah,
which it's not like, the blank of blank or the something something.
Like not the kidnapping of doom.
The curse of fatal death. It's just Kidnap. I feel like the working title is probably the Kidnap episode, and they're like, no, let's just scrub out words 1 and 3.
And the thing is, the kidnapping doesn't happen until the cliffhanger.
Yeah.
The cliffhanger is the kidnapping. The whole episode, you're like, what the fuck does this have to do with kidnapping?
That is frequently the case, though, where it's like, what cave? There's hasn't been a cave this entire time. Oh, okay, they're in a cave now, it's the very end. Or, it's literally the next episode where they get to the cave, because it's always a cave.
It reminds me of any episode where it's like, blank of the Daleks, and the reveal of the Daleks is like, oh, we weren't expecting this. It's like, the story is called Planet of the Daleks, come on!
It's called Episode of Daleks.
You can't be upset that there's a killer robot on the rampage when the story is called Robot.
Story is called Robot of Death.
Actually, the Robots of Death is a real story, and it is about robots who kill people.
Awesome.
I looked at it once. There is a ton of episodes that have of death, or death just in general.
Oh, there's a bunch of them. My favorite title of any classic Doctor Who story, by the way, is The Deadly Assassin, because it's like, well, you could just call that one The Assassin, because an assassin by his very nature is deadly. It's a tautology. It's like saying pin number. Like, a non-lethal assassin isn't an assassin. It's a guy who's crap at killing people.
No, but I want to read that. So I want to watch that story of the polite assassin, the overly amicable assassin,
the determined assassin, the well-meaning assassin, the assassin who just hasn't had his big break yet, the unlucky assassin. There we go.
That's
a Dormunder book.
That's more interesting than the deadly assassin, though.
The deadly assassin. Yeah, it's pretty marvelous.
The only way it could get better if it was in the cave.
The cave of the deadly assassin. The comic relief Doctor Who charity special that they did in 1998 that starred Rowan Atkinson as the Doctor and was written by Stephen Moffat, by the way, and it's on YouTube, is called The Curse of Fatal Death. It's brilliant.
I love that. I've seen it. That's good.
It's so good.
So, I guess back to the thing that we're doing.
Oh yeah, that podcast.
Kidnap!
Well, Ian goes to the aqueduct, and I have no recollection of what happens there, but somehow he gets better.
We hear, roar, and then we see Ian looking sick, and I was like, is the monster Ian's stomach?
He's gonna puke.
Yeah, the cliffhanger is, there's a noise. So the Doctor finds... No, the Doctor finds Deadly Nightshade. That's what happens. He's like, oh, Deadly Nightshade! And then there's rah, rah, rah. And then they roll the credits because they ran out of film.
They find the Doctor. Ian and Susan, I think. They find the Doctor and he's out cold. And I think, like, Ian, like, listens to his heartbeat or something again and is like... Only one of them.
Fun fact, popular fan theory, or headcanon, or fanon, or bullshit, as people accurately call it, is that Time Lords don't grow their second heart until after their first regeneration.
That's plausible to me.
My headcanon is that Ian's just stupid.
Yeah, that works. Ian is just a big, dumb moron.
Like, Ian's looking for a heartbeat, and he's not finding one, and he's like, Or he hears two, and he just doesn't want to say anything. So he's like, yeah, he's... Fine.
Have you ever tried to find your own pulse but you can't find it? I feel like Ian's like that but with literally every other person on the planet.
I don't know, but he's probably dead.
Oh, yeah, he's dead. Yeah, he walks around declaring people dead and then can't hear two hearts beating. It's just this guy, he's not a medical doctor. He's not. He's a history teacher, right?
I mean physics.
No, science. Yeah, he's science. He's science.
Is he science? Oh, he's science and she's history.
Yes.
Yeah.
But clearly, he's not good with biology. He's not a biology teacher. He doesn't understand what being alive is. One day in one story, he's going to go up and say, this computer is dead. Well, yeah, because it's an inanimate object and it doesn't have any, like, consciousness.
We have, like, a running joke in the podcast of Ian just declaring things alive and dead, because in Unearthly Child, in the very, very first episode, he touches the TARDIS and he says,
it's alive!
It's vibrating! It must be alive! And, like, Ian, no.
In that case, my sister keeps something in her, her bedside drawer that is probably alive. I don't know why I went with my sister. I don't want to go with a female that I know in my world. And for some reason, I went with my sister. I wonder if there's something Freudian in there. Maybe I should just stop talking.
You went ahead and made it weird.
We added BDSM censor rights to this story. I think it was already pretty weird to begin with.
No, that's true. That was pretty mundane. I don't know where we are anymore.
They get the doctor. My next note says, John is all fucked up.
That's true. John is all fucked up.
And then family group blackmail. I don't remember the specifics, but I remember they kept using the phrase
family group, and it was bothering you.
Because it's such a weird... It's deadly it's assassin. It's deadly assassin. It's
family group. It's baby chicklet. It's like baby chicks. Well, a chick is a baby chicken by default, so you don't need to call it a baby That's my sister was saying, because my sister has a three-year-old.
Three-year-old and a vibrator.
And she was saying, what show was it? Team Umizoomi. And she was saying that there's this episode where they've got to find these chicks, and they keep calling them baby chicks, and it was pissing her off, because it's like, they're chicks! By default, they're already babies! Why? It's like saying baby kitten.
Aw, baby kitten!
Or untalented Baldwin, you know? It's these things are... Although Alec Baldwin is the exception to that rule, by the way. Just throwing that out there.
I don't know. Have you seen Steven's work in Biodome?
I have not, but I choose not to. I have a deeply rooted interest in not seeing Biodome.
Out of respect to the families involved?
Yes.
I don't know where we are.
They're at the aqueduct still.
Let's see. I've got Susan mocks the censorites because she's just insensitive.
She just points and laughs.
Susan laughs in front of people's faces a lot.
She, like, reacts oddly to everything, though. Like, she'll laugh in the face of things, but then, like,
scream,
get a glimpse of someone
the person
and
moved.
Scream.
Yes. Yeah. My favorite odd reaction she has is at the beginning of the Aztecs, where she goes, look, cartoons! They got bubbles coming out of their mouths! And it's like, Susan...
Is she fine?
You're from an advanced society. Why? They have bubbles!
Wait, aren't we skipping the part where the doctor talks about, hey, I think that one of the censorites wants to fuck up our shit, and that the beast is a monster, that monster in the aqueduct is poisoning everything, and then a censorite who's loyal to that other censorite, who is one of the BDSM censorites, overhears this? That happens, right? I didn't imagine that.
Yeah, probably.
I believe you. We believed every other ridiculous thing that you've said.
Including the BDSM censorites, yes. Oh, this is the story where they go, oh, maybe we should see if Barbara wants to participate in the narrative now.
The bad guys kill the second elder, right?
So, something happens where we've said that the things with the suspenders and the collars. Collar guy is like, I'm going to wear the fancy suspenders and
no one will know. You're getting it wrong, I think.
I don't. Well, then tell me.
No guy steals the collar from the guy who has the collar, right?
Is the collar guy good?
The collar guy is good.
I don't remember.
I think it speaks volumes about the brilliance of the narrative in this serial that we have no clue what is going on at this point. At this point, they're just like, we'll just write any old bollocks. No one's watching anyway. What were the ratings like for this episode? Let me have a look. Kidnap had 6.9 million viewers. Remembering this is the 60s, and it was basically the choices of network were BBC or, I guess, not owning a television.
Oh, you didn't have to work as hard.
So yeah, like here's how I think it goes. Suspenders is the leader. Collar is the second leader. And, like, the bad guy just doesn't have nothing.
Okay.
I think.
He's bitter because he doesn't get to participate in the sexy romps.
So he kills collar guy and steals the collar and is pretending to be collar guy.
Because all censorites look alike. He's using the social construct of racism to his own benefit.
But all the censorites are like, yeah, that's probably him. He's got the collar.
Why would it be anyone else?
He changes his voice, too.
He changes his voice, but he doesn't sound like the guy.
He's like, oh, hello! I'm that guy with the collar now. I'm totally him. Yeah, it's definitely him. It does. Is that Greg? Yeah, that sounds like Greg. But it looks like Dave. No, it's got to be Greg.
He's got the collar.
He's got the collar and the voice. Come on. Yes, I'm definitely not me. I'm Greg. Okay, cool.
They bought it.
This is like Inspector Gadget levels of just broad incompetence. It's marvelous.
Yeah, they framed the Doctor for that murder.
The thing that keeps happening to Team TARDIS, actually.
And then, like, Ian has to, like, defend the Doctor, and he does a way better job of it than when the Doctor was being his lawyer in Marinus. It just totally lost the case.
You get Ian being like, look, he didn't do it, it's awesome. And then the Sansa's like, okay, cool. And then Ian looks at the Doctor and goes, you're welcome. That's how it's done. Booyah. Actually, fun fact, people don't know this, but Ian coined the phrase booyah. 1964, earliest use of that word, yeah.
I saw that on a special somewhere.
It's on a documentary on the DVD.
Did he ever say what specifically booyah means?
Like, to him?
Yeah.
Boo means brilliant, outstanding occasion, and yah is an acknowledgement of said brilliant, outstanding occasion, hence booyah.
Yeah.
I am so glad that's been cleared up. I've been wondering ever since I saw that serial, or that episode.
They actually, he says it, and then they elaborate on what it means in the novelization.
Oh.
Because you have to remember, Doctor Who predates home video by about 20 years, so a lot of the early serials, in fact, almost all of the classic stories, except for I think 4, were novelized. And some of the novelizations are really, really good, and some of the novelizations are not so good, such as a lot of them. And then there's the stories that Douglas Adams wrote are 3 of the 4 stories that were never novelized because they could never come to an agreement with his agent.
We need to have a new, like, a reoccurring segment on this podcast, and it's just Ben Padden's made-up classic Who facts.
Some of what I just said is true, by the way. Everything I said about the novelizations is true.
I thought it's the booyah thing. There's novelizations.
The booyah thing's not true?
The booyah thing is a fraud. That was me defrauding your podcast. And literally lying to almost 10 people. Your podcast has like 8 listeners, right? Yeah. So
see, I knew the booyah thing was fake because you said they elaborated on it.
In the novelization.
In the novelization. But that's what they would do in the episode. They would just like, let's take a long amount of time to explain something that does not need to be explained.
But then they would spend more time on that in the novelizations. Like, I'm not even joking. That is a legitimate thing.
Wow.
That's fascinating to me. Oh my God. How could it be more time?
Some of the novels are great. And it's good because that's how I get the missing stories. Because the stuff that is missing from the BBC archives, I have the novelizations of those as well. So that's how I've seen / read them.
No. We've been doing the reconstructions.
Oh, the reconstructions are difficult to watch. I can't watch them.
I've only watched one reconstruction, and it's Marco Polo. It was pretty painful.
There's an official reconstruction of Marco Polo on the disc for Edge of Destruction, where they take the entire serial and edit it down to 30 minutes.
We watched the whole thing.
We watched the whole thing.
You've also got the option of, like, BBC Audio sells the CDs with just the sound on them, with linking narration where necessary.
See, I like the visual reconstruction. I've seen some reconstructions where they use that audio, and it's a lot better. So you got, like, visuals and audio, but also the linking narration. I remember there was one specifically, I think it was the Celestial Toymaker, where they used the narration to cover up, like, a really awkward, like, racial slur.
Yes, it was the Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Moe, and it's the version of that rhyme where the N-word is prominently featured, which is one of the things that Jeremy Clarkson got in trouble for, because he did Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Moe, and said the N-word and got in trouble for it on Top Gear.
Ow.
It's one of many reasons why he got fired. I don't get why people are angry that the BBC fired Jeremy Clarkson, considering that the thing they ultimately fired him for, and let's not underplay this, he literally took a swing at one of the producers of the Top Gear. He went to punch him in the face. Now, if you go to punch one of the people in the face, who is literally your boss, I think that's a point where, yeah, maybe you should not have that job anymore. But the thing is, the media in the UK described it as a fracas the whole time. It's like describing, like, World War II as a kerfuffle. It seriously downplays what happened, and what happened was Jeremy Clarkson went to punch an Irishman in the face. So, yeah, I'm glad he lost his job. Screw him.
I knew nothing about this till just this second.
Well, now you know.
We have all that information. Thanks.
It's irrelevant to the podcast.
I like the irrelevant
Speaking
stuff.
Of the podcast.
John has a miracle cure, and is fine now, and knows who the bad guys.
And he gets reunited with, what's her name, Carol?
His fiancé.
Yes. We never mentioned that before, but that's totally a thing. I'm pretty sure the show plays it the exact same way.
Yeah, like, that happens a lot. Like, oh yeah, these characters in a relationship, and there's no real, like meat behind any of it.
It's like, yeah, we just said that they're in a relationship.
They'll... So that there's, like, mild amount of stakes. They're going to go back into the aqueduct.
Ian, by the way, has gotten an antidote.
Okay,
probably. I don't remember seeing it happen, to be honest. Like, watching the episode, I was like, I guess he has the antidote and he's better now.
Just everything is suddenly fine.
This show will, like, spend forever explaining stuff that you don't need explained, and then just gloss over stuff that you're like, wait a minute, I'm confused. What happens? They go into the aqueduct, but, the aqueduct, they go into the aqueduct.
Yes.
The new collar guy who used to be...
yeah.
He's like, let's give them maps that we've scribbled on with crayons and weapons that don't have bullets so that they will die.
It's like the American war effort. Which war? Oh, all of them. Just the every war that America's participated in.
They give them the radio antennas that don't work.
That play jazz, right?
How the ones that did work played jazz. I don't remember.
They gave them a radio that didn't work, a gun with no bullets, a Sudoku puzzle magazine where all of the puzzles had been filled in, and a copy of The Simpsons Season 1 on DVD that was missing discs 1, 2, and 4.
So they go back to the aqueduct, and Barbara's back in by now, right?
Probably. Is that...
Yeah, she's like, hey, I guess I'm here for the narrative, I'm participating.
I don't even think she really does anything.
Well, I think Barbara's the one who, like, looks at the map and is like, this map's not right, this has been messed with. And, like, just immediately is like...
She doesn't appear till episode 6. She's not in Kidnap.
They have the weapons, and, like, Ian's like, this doesn't work, and is, like, shoving it into the doctor's face, like, look!
Look at this gun!
Down the barrel! Then Carol gets kidnapped, because, because they have to make the title make sense.
The hand-grabbing Carol, that's the cliffhanger, as I recall.
Is it, I guess it had something to do with John being cured, so he's no longer babbly and weird. So
yeah, he's like, hey, everything's good forever now. Yay.
I was kind of spacing out by this point.
Yeah, there's so much going on.
And then we're on to episode 6. Let's just spin on. Let's just get through this.
A desperate venture is us getting through this. So the Ian and the doctor figure out the map's all screwy, wobbly, wobbly.
They're just like, yep, this map's been messed with. We'll just ignore it.
There's the part where Carol is forced by the sensorites to write a letter saying that, yeah, she's on the spaceship. And they're like, okay, you got to sit down, write it good. Penmanship counts. And then that's the thing.
Sensorite penmanship is very important. It's really stressed in that culture.
Of course. Again, calligraphy classes is important.
Which scene do you think was better? The scene where the sensorites make them, make her write a letter, or the episode where the Daleks make
Susan write a letter?
About the vegetables.
We grow leafy vegetables. That's my favorite.
Did you write the part about the vegetables? You will write about the vegetables.
That is the height of classic Who villainry, is we will force you to write a strongly worded letter.
Susan, take a letter.
And Ian and the doctor bump into... the monster that turns out to be a man.
It turns out it's man. Futurama reference.
That's
one of my favorite Futurama jokes.
I don't think I remember that episode.
It's a scary door episode that played over the end credits. It's one of the rare instances where they had something play under the end credits at the end of an episode. It's marvelous. It's like this mad scientist, who's taking all the DNA from the most evil animals in creation and puts them together, and then this guy just steps out of the genetic machine and just says, "It turns out it's man."
The people from the story before that none of us remembered, from the crash, they have all survived and they're living
in the aqueducts. The cave of aqueducts. Yeah, and they're like, we're plotting to kill the sensorites.
Yeah, we're going to kill all the sensorites so we can take their precious, unpronounceable material.
The wonderflonium.
And then Barbara suggests to, like, Susan, she's like, let's mind meld and help them out, right?
Copyright 1969. Paramount Enterprises, CBS and Desilu.
Yeah, so, like, they connect, they mind connect and, like, share what's going on inside and outside. and they speak so that the audience can hear instead of just thinking.
They're thinking psychically at each other, but saying what they're thinking out loud for your benefit.
And then I have boring wrap-up. So yeah,
they basically capture everyone who is living in the aqueduct.
And they're like, just walk out, and then, yeah, that's it. I don't even know what happened to, like, the bad Sensorai. I have no clue. I don't remember.
I think they just arrested him.
Did they arrest him?
They were just like, yeah, he's bad. We're going to arrest him with all the other... I don't know. Does anyone?
It was so weird to, like, introduce these survivors in the very last episode.
You introduce them and then wrap it up.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like something you'd introduce, like, halfway through the narrative. Or at least give them an episode to breathe.
Because pretty much you find out about their existence and it's like, well, I guess we're going to arrest them then. And then maybe... And then the Sensorites will let us go?
Are we skipping to the end here? Because the last paragraph at the end of this article is a brilliant summary of how the story ends.
I mean, I don't remember anything besides the end.
Are you ready for this? Do you want me to read this? I'm going to read this. Sometime later, in the TARDIS, the travelers are watching on the scanner an image of the spaceship disappearing into space on its way back to Earth. Ian comments that at least Carol, John, and Maitland know where they're going. This angers the Doctor, who says that wherever they land next, he's leaving Ian there. Wah, wah.
He gets so angry!
I've got to... Tony made a post about this that is the funniest post. She made it on Tumblr. I've got to find it, because it's a summary of the scene that is perfect.
The Doctor throws, like, a Kardashian-level fit about this offhanded remark, like, ha-ha, at least they know where they're going, right, Doctor? And the Doctor's like, fuck you.
This is what I have. Susan says, I wish we could go home sometimes. And the Doctor's like, yeah, but the stupid TARDIS doesn't work right. And then Ian's like, imagine if you actually knew how to fly it. And the Doctor's like, imagine if you got the fuck off my ship.
Oh, imagine if I pushed you out into the cold depths of space, you fucking nerd.
This is the second time he's threatened to do that, by the way. Not the first, the second.
This is the best ending to an episode.
So far.
So far.
Because Ian has this look on his face like, are you for real? What's one of my favorite things in Edge of Destruction? After they figured out that it was just a button was stuck.
Yeah.
That was making everything be unimaginably weird.
I love it. That's wonderful.
The Doctor's like, oh yeah, you were right. I totally did poison you. And Ian's like, I knew it. Oh, Doctor.
It's like the xylophone moment at the end of an episode of classic Star Trek. The xylophone moment is what I like to refer to, is the bit when the story's finished and you've got Kirk, McCoy, and Spock talking, and Spock says something that is emotionless. Then Kirk and McCoy are like, haha, well, you're an alien and you don't get it. Ha 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 ha. And then Spock says something, and the other guys think it's adorable, and you get this bit of xylophone music that goes ding 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 ding. And then it just cuts to a shot of the Enterprise flying away, executive producer Gene Coon. Like, that's it. So this is the xylophone moment, is the Doctor saying, get the fuck out. Get out. I'm not even kidding. I'm not even kidding. Get off my ship.
Ian's just like, aww, you're so alien and funny. Doctor's like, no, really, I'm opening the airlock now. Get the fuck out. And so, the great thing about it is that next serial he'll probably be like...
Just kidding, JK.
JK, let's go on an adventure.
JK, lol. Actually, what happens at the start of the next serial, and I don't want to spoil it for you, is they land in like 1794 in France. And the Doctor's all, okay, here we are, this is Earth, whatever, get the fuck out. Ian and Bob are basically, but listen to us, the Doctor, you are the best and smartest at all things, and we love you. Oh, we love you. Let's kiss. And then the Doctor's like, oh, you. And that's how the next serial starts. It's brilliant. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, obviously, but...
That all sounds super legit to me. They're just like, no, wait, Doctor. You're so smart. Let's tell you how smart and great you are. Please don't drop us off in the past.
Let's sum up what we thought about this episode, or this serial.
I think it gets off to a very prominent, like, the first episode, I really love. I love the tension and the mystery of what's happening, and then the first appearance of that Sensorite at the window. We made fun of it, but I love that. I love all of that. We talked at length about how great the Sensorites look. I think they are fantastic. Yeah, oh, they're so good. I feel like the premise is really, really strong, but like with a lot of classic serials, particularly during Hartnell's first couple of years, they hit the ground running, and then they kind of go, oh crap, what next? And then they kind of slow to a crawl. or they repeat themselves, like in, you know, the Daleks, where you have them walking back and forth through the jungle 18 times over the course of, what is it, 8 episodes or whatever. It feels like a lot of these classics, or what I say classic series, just specifically like the Hartnell era stuff, they have really strong ideas but don't really know what to do with them. And I feel like The Sensorites is a brilliant idea that wasn't quite executed on as well as they would have liked. Visually, I love it. I love the way this serial looks. And it feels, I mean, I was going to say it feels like vintage sci-fi. It is vintage sci-fi. but it feels like the mental image of when I think about what classic Doctor Who is, particularly this black and white era of Doctor Who, this is what I see in terms of like the camera angles, the lighting, the set design, the aliens, everything about it. I love it. I just wish that I wish that it didn't fall to pieces after episode 2.
I like it as well, and it does. It's like it's every couple of episodes, it's like, eh, let's throw in a new direction and it, that it didn't really need to go. Introducing, like, sort of the big bads in the last, like, half of the last episode.
Yeah.
Terrible idea. But yeah, I really like the design of the Sensorites, and that first episode is, like, legitimately creepy and, like, you're wondering what's going on.
It's very, I don't think we talked about it too much, but it is very unsettling, that first episode, when you're still trying to kind of place what is happening to these people, and why aren't they letting them go, why are they keeping them, why aren't they killing them. And I think the Sensorites are very interesting in that they want to be nonviolent, but they also don't want to get screwed over.
Yeah. And then once you start revealing more of that, you lose interest.
It's tricky, but I think that there's good intentions in a lot of the narrative seeds that they introduce. If you were to remake this story for modern Doctor Who and do it as either one 45-minute story or a two-parter, I think it could work really well, because all of the right ingredients are there, but just putting a bag of flour and a box of eggs in a pot doesn't make a cake. So everything doesn't quite come together in the end. The promise of the first two episodes is not fulfilled by the back four.
And I feel like the grumpy Sensorite, whose name I don't really
care about. I don't remember secondary characters' names at all, ever. I consistently haven't.
His name is Grumpy. I've just looked it up online. His name is officially Grumpy. That's how it's scripted. that is fact. Please don't look it up to contradict me.
He said it with his British accent, and I believe him.
Right. So, Grumpy, I feel like Grumpy is the exact same character as Tagana in Marco Polo, the exact same character as the Butcher in the Aztecs. It runs a lot of very similar ground.
There were characters, a couple of characters just like that in An Unearthly Child. It's just, it's part of the theme is, here are some people, oh look, maybe we should trust them. No, for arbitrary reasons. Like, that's an archetype that is very prevalent in early classic Doctor Who.
Yeah, it's, they constantly get Scooby-Dooed by Team TARDIS. I wouldn't have gotten away with it!
Weren't for you meddling time travelers.
Like, desperately trying to be evil, even though it would have been a lot easier to just not be evil. Like, ah, we've made an antidote for your people. Fuck that!
Yeah, again, the audio story I just listened to involves a political assassination, that politician coming back from the dead as a sound wave that hops from sound machinery to sound machinery, and someone, a political rival, who was like editing old recordings of this person's speeches to make it sound like he'd endorsed her, when really he'd been like, she's fucked up, what are you doing? And it's like, wouldn't it be easy just to like build a political campaign and then run on that, rather than try to stand on the shoulder of someone better than you, whom, I mean, this information is all in the public domain anyway, so it just seems kind of weird. And even after she's found out, she's like, haha, I'm still doing it. And it's like, well, why? What's, no? That's the dumb, that's literally the dumbest thing. And then they do that thing at the end where there's a broadcast, and while the broadcast is going on, she's like saying, oh, I had him killed, and I would do it again, it's all for the greater good. And then the doctor's all, actually, we just broadcast that, psych on you. And she's like, grr, my plans! Do you know my favourite thing that Doctor Who villains do? My favourite thing is when one of their lackeys says, someone's shown up, he's called the Doctor, he's broken the stuff, it's going to ruin the plans. And then the villain says, well, then our plans must be accelerated. And my immediate response to that is, if you could have been going faster this whole time, why weren't you? Were you so confident and cocksure that everything would work out fine. That you were just like, we're just going to coast. It's fine. We know we're good. We know we're golden. It's like, if you'd been operating at full pelt since the beginning, you could have been grand ruler of planet Zog, like, 15 minutes before the TARDIS even arrived. Like, just, if you can operate at that speed, why wouldn't you? Why do you have to wait for someone to come fuck up your shit before you go, oh, I guess we better turn the dial up to 100% instead of having it all the way down here at 30. If the knob goes all the way to 11 and you're operating at 3, don't be surprised when someone says, this isn't very loud. That's all I'm saying. That's all I'm saying.
I think what it is Doctor Who villains get paid by the hour and not for the job.
Oh, you're right, yeah.
So they're trying to just pad out that paycheck.
They don't want
to
go too fast. They want to get the job done. They want to make some money.
If there is a moral to the Sensorites, it's outsiders are bad, but they're also good, but maybe they're also bad.
Also, loud noises are scary, and so is the dark.
Basically, if you're an agoraphobe, this is the story for you. You'll find something to relate to in the Sensorites.
Sensorites.
Woo! We did it. Yeah!
High fives!
Great hustle. Good going. Good times, podcast people.
Thank you for joining us for this journey.
No problem.
Into the Sensphere.
Into the Sensphere.
Journey into the Sensphere should have been an episode.
That's a good title, yeah.
That's a great title. Let's say that's what Kidnap is called, because they do go into the aqueducts. Because Kidnap's a dumb title.
It's a shame we don't title our podcast.
This one's just The Sensorites.
Yeah.
/Ben Patton.
That sounds like I'm with the Sensorites. You're either with the Sensorites or you're against the Sensorites. I sound a little bit like the boss in the IT crowd.
Which one?
The first boss. The one who jumps out the window.
Not the second one.
The second one.
Father!
Father! He was in a recent episode of Community.
The grifting teacher.
The grifting teacher. I would be done with you. Matt Berry is his name. He's brilliant.
Yeah, I love him.
I'm going to interrupt with a completely random thought.
That doesn't happen on this podcast very often.
I think we should start ending the podcast on cliffhangers, because I thoroughly enjoyed the last one.
You know what? I don't want this podcast to end on a cliffhanger. In fact, if you end it on a cliffhanger, you're all dead!
Tune in next time for the Reign of Terror!